Thanks for tuning in for the April 23rd podcast. I'm Bob Gross, editor-in-chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's featured interview highlights a neurology clinical practice article on the Montreal Cognitive Assessment as a screening tool. For our What's Trending feature of the week, you'll hear an interview discussing serum neurofilament dynamics for prediction of neurodegeneration and clinical progression in presymptomatic Alzheimer's disease. Please remember we offer free CME to AAN members for each eligible podcast, and we welcome your feedback at podcast@aan.com.
Hi, this is Greg Day from Washington University in St. Louis. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Brigid Waldron-Perrine from Wayne State University School of Medicine concerning her paper published in this week's issue of Neurology Clinical Practice titled Use of the MoCA as a Screening Tool, Influence of Performance and Symptom Validity. Brigid, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Your paper studies the non-neurological factors that might influence the performance of veterans who've had a mild traumatic brain injury on a 30-item, one-page bedside test of cognitive function, one we all know and love, the Montreal Cognitive Assessment. Before we get into the details, could you tell us why this work matters to all of us who are engaged in patient care on a daily basis?
Absolutely. I think it's really important that when we're using any kind of tool to measure cognition, that we're aware of all of the factors that are going to influence the individual's performance on that measure. So it's very important for everyone who is using cognitive screening instruments, including neurologists and neuropsychologists and other types of providers, to be aware of the non-neurological factors that can influence cognitive performance. If you make diagnoses or develop treatment plans based on patient subjective complaints or performance on cognitive screening instruments, you need to be aware of what influences the score that is the basis for making those decisions.
So we really need to know how to interpret the findings from the measures that we're applying on a daily basis, is what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Great. A very important point. So what are the major or most important findings from your study that you want to share with our audience?
Well, I think the big picture is that as we measured engagement in testing in general via techniques known as performance validity tests, that are well known within the field of neuropsychology, we found that the more flags, so to speak, of invalidity that we were finding, the lower the score on the MoCA. So it stands to reason then when individuals are performing at a certain level in the clinic that this might be influenced by effort or task engagement or even just interest in performing well or poorly on the measure. I think the second most important takeaway finding is that factors such as belief that one has difficulty with cognition or symptoms of anxiety disorders such as post-traumatic stress disorder, that these factors also influence performance on the screening tool, the MoCA, and that we need to be clear on what we're really measuring with this screening instrument in order to make the most appropriate recommendations on the basis of the performance.
Great point. And so really the way that a patient is approaching the scenario and the baggage that they bring with them to the appointment matters.
Absolutely.
Now, although this study is focused primarily on identifying measurable patient-driven factors that might influence performance, you know, specifically of veterans with a mild TBI on the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, so just one measure, it sounds like your findings really do extend well beyond this population and well beyond people using this one cognitive test. Do you think that the factors that you've identified in this population with this test might affect our interpretation of other bedside tests that clinicians are regularly using, such as the mini mental status examination, for example?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question, and the answer is absolutely. Any test, any screener can be impacted, and this can occur in any patient population. It's not specific to any patient population whatsoever. You know, for example, I can think of a friend's family member who was administered the MoCA, and on the basis of his performance, his driving privileges were revoked. And, you know, it became clear afterward that his performance was in large part due to him just not seeing the point of doing this silly test. And so he was not particularly engaged. He didn't put forth his best effort. And he was unaware of the downstream consequences. So I think that, you know, we all need to be responsible users of the tools in our toolkits and, you know, be aware of the myriad factors that can influence performance on these measures across populations and across tests.
Very good to know. Very important for those of us using these tests on a daily basis to make those important decisions. Now, of course, I think the great things about this study is that you and your team really took the time to systematically measure specific patient-driven factors, the ones that you've talked about that can affect validity and affect test performance. And ultimately, of course, that's the beauty of clinical research in a controlled environment. But what advice do you have for the average neurologist, perhaps one of us who doesn't have the staff or the specific measures that we can use to look for these other things that might influence performance? What kind of symptoms could we screen for in our patients, or signs on a routine neurological examination, or just the encounter with the interview that might put us on to something that maybe efforts complicating performance, or maybe there's another diagnosis, a mood disorder or something else that we need to take into account before making a decision based on test findings?
So the considerations that I would say neurologists, you know, should be paying attention to are implausible patterns of performance on the cognitive screening instruments. For example, being able to do a more cognitively demanding task relatively easily, but sort of stumbling over a much simpler task. And that's always a good time to refer to your friends and colleagues in neuropsychology, who often have the benefit of being able to spend more time with the patient to do a much more thorough assessment of their cognitive functioning, as well as their emotional and psychosocial functioning, to really put all those pieces together so that you can better understand your patient and get them the types of treatment and interventions that they need.
Perfect. Very handy advice. And I think we're always looking for those triggers of when do we need to reach out and seek assistance from others. Still, though, if we're in the office, so practically speaking, if we identify a few of these factors, these inconsistencies, this fluctuation in performance between perhaps the interview and the actual bedside cognitive test, are there tricks that we can use to adjust for these? And is it permissible to provide more encouragement? Do we try another measure, try the test again? What would you recommend, you know, if it's really important that we do sort of try to get optimal performance on some of these tests?
Yeah, you know, the literature in neuropsychology is fairly clear that it is very difficult to fix that scenario once you're sort of seeing the colors of it shine through. And so unfortunately, in many of these cases, you know, the rule of thumb is that if the data doesn't make sense, then we shouldn't consider it valid data. It is unfortunately invalid data. And we might be able to get valid data on another occasion if a patient is very sleepy or, you know, is having just a really bad day. Perhaps we could have them come back and try again with that measure or another measure. But I think the biggest caution that I have is to not interpret data that very well might be invalid, because harm could come of that. And sometimes we need to just sort of, you know, say, well, this screen didn't deliver for me, but here's all the other information that I have that I can make these clinical decisions. I've interviewed the person's spouse or their child. I've spent, you know, a few minutes with them talking about their mood, and it's clear there's a problem there, and that's probably affecting their cognition. So, you know, don't interpret invalid data, and then use all of the other tools at our disposal, all of the other investigative techniques, and in particular, our interview skills, to really try to figure out what is the best next step.
Well, thank you for that reminder. And I think we do all need to be reminded from time to time that screening tests are screening tests for a reason. We're going to be subject to limitations and not going to work in all patients all the time. So that's some great advice. In the few seconds that we have left together, could you summarize for me sort of the key take-home message that you want our listeners to remember about your paper?
Yeah, I think the take-home message is that we all need to interpret positive cognitive screens cautiously, consider the many factors that can contribute to low performance on a screening tool, and when in doubt, refer for further evaluation if you believe that it is warranted. The American Board of Professional Psychology and American Board of Clinical Neuropsychology have websites that you are able to use to find a board-certified neuropsychologist in your area who I'm sure would be happy to collaborate with you on what's going on with your patient and try to point them forward in the best way possible.
So paying attention, cautiously interpreting, and referring when needed. I think
Yes. That's
a great message. Thank you, Bridget, for expanding on those important points, and really thank you for taking the time to discuss this important paper with our audience.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I've been speaking with Dr. Bridget Waldron-Perrine about her paper titled Use of the MoCA as a Screening Tool, Influence of Performance and Symptom Validity, which you can read in this week's Neurology Clinical Practice.
I'm Jeff Burns from the University of Kansas Alzheimer's Disease Center. Today we're discussing what's trending in the search for a blood biomarker for Alzheimer's disease. I'm talking with Matthias Uecker from the German Center for Neurodegenerative Diseases and the University of Tübingen. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Uecker.
Thank you for having me.
So the field of Alzheimer's disease biomarkers has advanced considerably in the last couple decades. There's an aggressive search, as you know, that's ongoing to better define biomarkers to detect Alzheimer's changes in the brain, which we know begin years, perhaps up to two decades, before the onset of any detectable cognitive symptoms. So before we get into the results of your study, talk a bit about where we are now in the search for biomarkers.
I think in the field of Alzheimer's disease, we are really privileged to have very useful and also partly validated biomarkers, which provide, as you said, very early information about the disease process. And this, as you said, to at least a decade or even two before symptoms appear. These biomarkers are typically either proteins measured in the cerebrospinal fluid or imaging modalities such as MRI or the positron emission tomography. What is now emerging, and this I think over the last 2 years, is we have seen that biomarkers in blood may be able to give us the same or in some instances even better information about the disease process, which without doubt would be a major achievement. I mean, taking CSF is an invasive procedure and imaging is time consuming and expensive, and at least for PET comes with radiation. So, and to take blood is fairly simple, as we all know.
Yes, we have CSF markers, we have imaging markers, and then, you know, the holy grail of biomarkers would be a simple blood-based biomarker. And this is one of the reasons that your recent study is so important. It uses a blood-based measure of something called neurofilament light. So tell us first, what is neurofilament light?
So neurofilament light is a protein of nerve cells. And this protein is part of the cell or neuronal cytoskeleton of the cell. So we abbreviated the neurofilament light and say NFL. And so you see the abbreviation NFL stands not only for your National Football League, but also for my protein in a way. So from mouse experiments, we know that if a nerve cell dies or is damaged, this NFL is released and is transported or leaks into the cerebrospinal fluid and then into the blood where it is fragmented, so it's degraded. And luckily for us, one of these fragments is very resistant to degradation. And what we measure in the end is this fragment of this neurofilament light. I mean, then we have in fact a readout in blood for neuron loss in the brain, which, I mean, not only me, but I think all of us think that's wonderful.
Yes, it sure is. And let's talk about what you found in your recent paper. Summarize very briefly, what are the key results?
Yeah, I would have to go back for 1 second in a study 2 years ago where we and many other papers actually too found higher levels of this neurofilament light in sporadic AD, sporadic Alzheimer's disease, compared to controls. So what we did in the most recent one was we used individuals that carry a genetic mutation that leads to Alzheimer's disease. And also in this cohort, we confirmed that these individuals developing Alzheimer's disease have increased levels of neurofilament in the blood. So we have it in sporadic, we have it in familial Alzheimer's disease, both show increased levels. So in this most recent study, and most importantly, and again, this was only possible since we used such individuals with a genetic mutation, which allowed us to predict the onset of the disease. Thus, most importantly, we found that NFL in blood starts to increase approximately 16 years before predicted symptom onset, which is, you know, that's 1.5 decades. That's a very, very long time. We also found that these early NFL changes are tightly correlated with loss of brain mass, brain shrinkage, which makes sense because we think the readout is nothing else than neuron loss. And it also correlates eventually with cognitive decline assessed by mini-mental state examination and logical memory tests. And finally, in this most recent paper, we did a proof of principle and in the real prospective study, and indeed could show that neurofilament levels in blood predicted the loss of brain mass and cognitive decline that occurred 2 years later. So in a way, it was not a retrospective study, it was in fact a prospective study.
Yeah, that's very impressive. And I do want to highlight that you did conduct this study in a very specific population of individuals in the dominantly inherited Alzheimer's network. So the results are specific for individuals carrying mutations for autosomal dominant forms of Alzheimer's disease, which offers you, you know, a lot of strengths, but this population represents less than 1% of those affected by Alzheimer's. So talk a little bit about, you know, how do these results apply potentially to the broader population of individuals who are at risk for sporadic forms of Alzheimer's?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good question. Indeed, these findings rely on data from over 400 individuals from this network. And current observations, however, suggest that the disease and pathogenesis between this familial form of Alzheimer's disease and the late onset sporadic form are indeed very, very similar, if not identical. And thus we think that our findings are also relevant for sporadic Alzheimer's disease. But saying this, it's really important to mention that familial forms occur much earlier. So the onset in the familial forms of Alzheimer's disease are between 40 and 50, and thus the subjects are fairly young and have, if I may say so, a clean or a pure Alzheimer's disease, while the sporadic forms are elderly individuals with typical lots of comorbidities in brain. And these comorbidities may also come with an additional nerve cell loss, which may or may not complicate our analysis. So in fact, I think it's translatable to the sporadic form, but these studies have to be done now.
So now also you looked at the predictive nature of a single measure at one point in time and also at how those measures changed over time within an individual. So you looked at dynamic measure of change with this NFL over time for individuals and compared how those predicted decline. So talk a little bit about that, you know, a single point in time versus a dynamic measure of change for an individual.
Yeah, indeed. To make it very short, the major finding was really that it's not the absolute neurofilament concentration, but rather the rate of change over a defined time period that really allowed us to make the best prediction about the future progression of the disease.
Okay, so yeah, dynamic measure of change was better, but a single point in time was still predictive, correct?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, great. Now, so where is this headed? What's next?
You know, that's exactly the example. For example, it is not yet apparent to us over what period of time the rate of change needs to be calculated. That's a major issue. So is it enough to take blood every week, every month, or do samples need to be taken over the course of a year? And then also, as I said, further refinements are needed and it has to be confirmed in sporadic AD. What definitely is going to happen, I think, as we speak, that NFL blood measurements will now be a major readout and incorporated in all clinical Alzheimer's studies to test whether a compound is able to change disease progression. And more on an individual level, once a medication or a compound is available, then neurofilament in blood will be a crucial biomarker on a, again, individual level to see whether the medication works for a given patient.
Well, that's great. Very exciting work. Thank you, Dr. Jucker, for joining us today and sharing this important information on the state of Alzheimer's biomarkers.
Thank you.
This is Bob Gross. Please check out this week's journal, which features an interesting paper on racial disparities in intervention rates in individuals with ALS, and another article on reproductive period and risk of dementia in a diverse cohort of healthcare members. Please take a look at these and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.